day to night. They actually go to 49 cycles during the day at heavy peak loads, and they go to 51 cycles at night. And apparently this is a economics measure. They save a lot of money not having to maintain the generators at exactly 50 hertz. And my question is, I'm working on a generator project at my house, so it's a little bit ham radio related. Have you heard anything, or is there any electricians out there who have heard anything like that in the States? Because I've monitored our frequency on Long Island. I put a frequency counter after I learned about this, and it's dead nuts at 60 all the time. And I've never heard of this before until last week. I was talking to a ham on 40 meters who resides in the UK. And the related question is, when we're using emergency power, in general, is there a rule of line frequency that we want to, that our ham radio equipment can tolerate or not? Over to Matt.
Interesting information there, Bob. Wow. If what you just said is true, I'm going to start checking with my buddies over there in the UK. I got a buddy who works for British Telecommunications, BT, I guess it's called. And that's the first question I'm going to ask him when I write him an email in the next couple of hours. Do they really change the frequency between nighttime and daytime for the power in the United Kingdom? Wow. The implications of that, if it's true, are massive. Let me tell you why it's not true in the United States. It's overly obvious that we have this huge power grid in the United States. In other words, that power generator in Ohio, that power generator in Maine, and that power generator in Maryland, and the one that on Long Island, are all tied together by the exact same chunk of copper that's stretching all those miles. It's all interconnected. We're all part of that power grid. And depending on which part of the country is using more power, various portions of that grid are either acting as a source or a sink of power. But our 60-cycle power is related back to the frequency reference of the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado. A cesium beam standard is being used not only to generate the exact frequencies for the color chrominance carrier for your color television network programming. In other words, you could put your frequency counter on the 3.5 megacycle, 3.579545 to be exact, that frequency of your color chrominance television picture when it's connected to a network. You could put your frequency counter on that, and you would find the accuracy is one part in 10 to the 12, maybe 10 to the 13 on a good day. So there are people who set up frequency references using that. Well, our power 60 cycles comes very close to that. And so we may shift in phase a little bit. And yes, you have to go up and down in frequency a tiny amount, millihertz. We probably deviate on any 1 hour by millihertz, and it's really just a phase shift. It's not a real frequency drift, if you know what I mean, depending on who's sourcing and who's thinking. So because of that power grid, and everybody has to be synchronized together, we're on exactly the same frequency. And by the way, if they did do it in the United Kingdom, allow it to slow down during the day and speed up at night, they're balancing the two to make sure that the clocks that are using synchronous motors don't gain and lose time. Otherwise, everybody would be arriving to work either too late or too early in the morning if they're using 50 hertz power to run their clock. And Europe is primarily on 50 hertz. Certainly the United Kingdom is. So I'm going to double check on that. Now, when it comes to your own generator in your own house, you'll notice that the generator itself into an open circuit probably is putting out 132 volts. And when you heavily load it, it comes down to about 118. You'll also notice that the governor of the generator is trying to keep it running at a constant speed, but it does definitely run slower under load than it does not under load. My guess is your generator in your house probably runs 63 hertz unloaded and 59 hertz when it's fully loaded, numbers like that. Your equipment itself that's running on a full-wave rectified capacitor input power supply that doesn't use a transformer, it wouldn't care if you went down to 40 hertz or up to 400 hertz. It wouldn't care. If you're running a piece of equipment that's got a power transformer, most power transformers are very happy with higher frequencies. If it's, the power transformer is designed for 60 hertz and you gave it 70 hertz, it would run colder. The converse is not true. You take 60 cycle power transformers that were designed for 60 cycles and you go over to the United Kingdom where it's running on 50 hertz, you'll find
COS lockup detect.
You'll find that the below frequency creates a significant increase in the amount of saturation of the magnetics of the iron of the transformer. In general, a transformer that's only designed for 60 hertz will run very hot on 50 hertz. It will make a loud buzzing sound, and it could even fail in the worst case. If the transformer is well designed for 50 hertz, it'll be okay on 50 hertz, and it'll run nice and cold on 60. So transformers are about the only thing I know of that are really frequency sensitive, and clocks, of course. Most other chunks of electronics, your refrigerator, your television.
Code number 7820, link clear.
Your television set, your refrigerator, most of these other things are pretty happy with significant changes in frequency. They're not very unhappy with it. About the only thing you might have some problems is that some air conditioners, depending on how the way they're wired, particularly a window-type air conditioner, may just barely start correctly on 122 volts and 60 hertz, and if you go down to 118 volts and 48 hertz, that air conditioner might not go into the start cycle correctly.
An error has occurred. COS lockup detect.
Ain't it nice that we've got the linking, web light linking to our repeater? As you can tell, the system is going through some growing pains as they're refining the bugs in it. So these are some of the interesting things about the power and frequency and voltage and whatever. And by the way, if your particular generator is trying to supply power to the grid as opposed to acting as a load, in other words, you've got excess power in your neighborhood and you want to supply it to the grid so the guy in Ohio is
more happy. An error has occurred. COS lockup detect.
So if the guy in Ohio is more happy, your first question would be, would I raise the frequency, raise the phase, or raise the voltage? And the answer is raise the voltage. As you raise the voltage generated by your generator, by controlling its magnetic field, you become a source of power as opposed to a sink of power. But again, you're not running multiple generators in your house, and the main thing you and I've got to worry about is, do we thoroughly disconnect ourselves from LIPA or LOCO before we turn on our generator? Otherwise, you're trying to pick up the whole block. I've made that mistake. During a power outage, I forgot to pull the main breaker, and I tried to backfeed my particular house, and the generator kept stalling until I realized I was attempting to pick up the whole block, and no way in heck did I have enough power to do that. Now, back to you, Bob. N2MPJ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Variable speed motor controls.
I didn't catch that double. Dick, you're exactly right. I went on a couple of different websites after I heard this, and they computer monitor the power, and they actually, during the night, make catch-up. That's where the 51 cycles comes in to play, because it's cheaper to run at 51 cycles at night with the low load. So between the two, they balance them out so all the clocks read the right time in the morning. But they have had complaints because the clocks can be off by several minutes right around dinner time at 6 o'clock. And I just thought it was an interesting thing. I'd never heard of such a thing before. And from what I gather from what you're saying, if I vary from like 59 cycles to 61 cycles, it probably wouldn't bother anything in ham radio land. That's about it. Thanks a lot, Dick. Over to you. And to MPJ.
Yeah, Bob. You could vary. You could go as low as 57 hertz and as high as 63 before you're going to see any change. Now, when your motor generator set, probably powered by gasoline or maybe liquid propane or natural gas, when it runs low or high in frequency, because the motor is running fast or slow, most likely the voltage is going up and down by direct proportion. So the worst thing that will happen if you run low in frequency is you're going to be lower in voltage output. You're going to be setting the generator, the governor, most likely to get a reasonable amount of voltage at the load at the other end of the cable. And whether the frequency goes down as low as 58 or as high as 63, I wouldn't worry about that. Very few pieces of equipment in your house other than the clock are even going to know the difference. But because we've got this massive grid in the United States, we are all locked together to an exact frequency. And yes, you could, if you want to, build a beautiful servo mechanism to exactly measure the frequency out of your generator, and with all kinds of operational amplifiers powering an actuator on your carburetor, you could force your generator to be at the exact frequency if you cared enough. It would be an interesting science experiment, but it's not required. Now, the fact that the United Kingdom does that strongly suggests that the United Kingdom is not connected to the European grid. They must be on thoroughly independent power. Otherwise, the chances of them doing that, the chances of them to get every other European country to agree to the magnitude of frequency lowering during the day under heavy load and raising at night, you would never get agreement among all of those zillions of countries over there in Europe. So I think if it's true, then the United Kingdom most of the time must be disconnected from the European grid. And amazing. As I said, I'm going to be checking with my buddy on this one. Okay, Bob, you were the last person on our list of people who signed in with questions. I know that Paul's got some nice information he's going to give us about what's going on in space. The International Space Station has got the shuttle up there right now. I think I read that each delivery of the Progress spaceship that brings up the consumable materials for the astronauts brings up 10,000 pounds of material are brought up on each delivery just to bring up oxygen, water, food, and other consumable materials. It, to me, is very strong evidence that human beings require a lot of consumable materials, replaceable materials, in order to sustain their life. On top of that, another thing I've seen recently is that a couple of people with some very good telescopes and very good cameras, charge couple device cameras connected to their telescopes, have started taking pictures of the International Space Station when it flies over on just the right sun angle and whatever. And you'll soon discover that the latest picture of the space of the International Space Station is an extremely elaborate piece of hardware. It's got all kinds of modules connected together, and those multiple solar arrays are really getting, that looks to me like they got more than an acre of solar arrays up there. I think, Paul, if you ask the average American to, with pencil and paper, make a quick cartoon sketch, a simple one-line sketch, so to speak, of what the International Space Station looks like right now, I suspect that 98% of the population could not do that, and I'm one of them. I'm not really sure exactly what the International Space Station looks like now. I know it's a lot more complicated than anything else we've ever put into space. Could you draw a picture of its current status and what it's going to look like when the new module is installed? WS2N, a space person, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Definitely, Dick, I could do that. My problem is trying to explain it clearly. It's stuck through the radio, but we could give that a try. But the Atlantis is up there now, STS-122, and they are installing the Columbus module, a new module. You know, one of these roughly 14-foot in diameter things, probably about 24 feet long. And that's being installed. Let's see, I guess they'll probably start doing that tomorrow if they haven't done it. I didn't listen to it today. But they did get up there. They docked with it. I got as far as that. And the next step is to attach the Columbus module to the Harmony node that was brought up there on the last flight. Now, Dick, they've been busy up there with the Progress ship that was launched a couple of days before the space shuttle that had to be docked and eventually unloaded. Before that, they had a spacewalk on board the International Space Station. There are three people now. Eventually, that number is going to be up. But right now, two of them went outside and did a spacewalk to try to get one of the motors operating. properly that pitches the solar arrays properly as it goes around the Earth. They did that. That had to be done really at nighttime. They didn't want any voltages coming across those panels when they were working out there. Because, you know, you're pulling out, you know, changing out wires and cables. So nighttime is a better way to go. They go around the Earth every 16 times in a 24-hour period, and they just waited. You know, every time they came around at nighttime, they would work on it during the period of time that they were out there, 5-6 hours, whatever it was. Let me drop it to see if this thing's working okay. This is WS2N.
Everything's working fine, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I don't monitor it myself, so. Very good, Dick. As far as the configuration, starting in, 1999, when they first launched the first piece up, what you would do is you would, the Russians put up the Zarya block, first section, living quarters of the space station. And then the, see, right after that, and that was unmanned at the time, they just launched it. The first flight was the Unity node by the United States Space Shuttle. We docked with it and bolted those two segments together. That was the first part of the International Space Station. Now, they're in line with one another. Two beer cans bolted together. Okay, so now the subsequent flights that have gone up, you've got your, in front of this node piece, you've got like one beer can, let's say, that is the Zarya module. That's they call it the functioning cargo block. A lot of batteries and equipment to run everything. Kind of like a machinist room in a skyscraper. That's number one that was put up there with this Unity, this interconnecting. Make a lot of different connections off this this piece, like six-sided, six connections really is what you had on this thing. So going down the line, then you needed the living quarters. They sent the Russian segment up first. That was the living quarters for the first crew. They started out with two people. So now you've got three pieces in line. That's the living quarters where the Russians set it all up for that way. Live, work, bathroom, everything. The functioning cargo block was next in line, and then followed by the Unity node, this multi, like dice-like figure, you know, except it's round. We could have different connections coming off of it. And then what they did, they started to build out from the top of this node, and they came out with the Z1 structure, a truss. And from there, they built the temporary solar panels, these 240 feet long by 40 feet wide. Two panels that were assembled came off of that, off the top of that. It was called the Z1, and then they had another truss section with the panel. And that was the configuration for quite a while there. Let me drop it. Okay, then now what happens is in the front of this Unity module now, one of the six ports, in line with this Russian component, that's the Russian living quarter, the functioning cargo block, the machinist room really, and this node, interconnecting piece, they eventually sent up Destiny. Now that's the living quarters for the and the lab for the United States. That's our module. So that was bolted to that. So now those four pieces are in line. Then out of the Z1 truss section, they eventually started to build to the port side and to the starboard side of this inline thing, with many truss sections. Actually, there's a total of 11 of them, and they're built you know, section after section. And these trusses are big, you know, they're like, again, 14 feet. They have a track, a mobile track, which rides along it, and it goes like, you know, a couple hundred feet one way or the other. The purpose of these things, twofold, is really to hold the main purpose is to hold these gigantic solar arrays that they started sending up as the flights progressed. Each set that they would bring up was 240 feet long by 40 feet wide. So now there's three sets of these things built on this long truss, a couple hundred feet long truss that's put up there. And that's why you got your acre of property up there filled with solar arrays that are visible now from Earth. So now that you're continuing on, in front of Destiny now, they had brought up another six-sided figure for interconnecting piece called Harmony. Now, Harmony is bolted to that Destiny lab, and in front of that, they are now bolting up the Columbus module. There's more things to go up in the future, but the Columbus module is big. Columbus module is going to be mounted vertically, not in line with the whole setup. So when you see it, the one that looks like it's perpendicular to the rest of it will be the Columbus module, Dick. So that's your main configuration. There's other big pieces that they brought up. They brought up the Quest docking module, where when they do a spacewalk from the International Space Station, they'll go into this gigantic room that was brought up separately by the shuttle. That's attached to the first node, the Unity node. There's a Pyrrhus docking module for the Russians in the back of this whole setup that they use for their spacewalks. The end of the module, the very end of it, you could have a Progress ship that would dock to it. In the front of all of this, where the Columbus module built by the European Space Agency that they brought up this week, in front of that, you're going to have the docking module for the space shuttle. So in line, well, from all the way back, you'll have the Progress ship, the Russian module, keep going, and you have a docking at the Unity port, six module piece. In front of that, Progress, Zesda, Zarya functioning cargo block. You've got the Unity connecting node. In front of that, you have the Destiny. In front of that, you have the new Harmony connecting node, the two of them. And then in front of that, now you have the Columbus lab deck. That's pretty much it. And then running perpendicular to that whole thing, you have all those trusses with all your solar arrays, and you have, of course, your radiators radiating heat from all the electronics and God knows what else that's on the space station deck. Back to you. This is WS2M.
Wow. Hey, Paul, you've impressed me. I'm amazed you can keep all this straight. I'm going to give you a homework assignment, Paul. Find me a website that will give me a schematic diagram of this hardware, where it currently stands and where it intends to go, but just a schematic diagram, a six-figure diagram of where we are. I wish there was a website that would make that clear. I mean, we're always a little bit embarrassed about the fact that you take the average high school kid and show him a map of the United States, and particularly the states out west, he can't fill in the names. He knows there's something called Idaho, Montana, and Colorado and whatever in Nevada, but he doesn't really know where they are. Well, by the same token, I'll bet very few Americans can draw you a schematic diagram of even the rough outline shape of the International Space Station, as well as going down to the individual modules. So I hope there's a website that gives me a stick figure of this. If not, I'd love it if you could find us one. And I got you off subject. I got you describing all these modules to us. Tell me what
the International Space Station and Space Shuttle are doing. You've already given us a hint. Also, I know that we had some interesting telescopes about to be launched this particular year. I think the next one going up is a gamma ray burst detecting telescope. And for those who don't know what a gamma ray burst is, it is by far the biggest bang you're ever going to hear about, except for the real Big Bang. The second in command to, in size is a gamma ray burst, where you take the total output of something like our sun, which is going to be giving us 1,300 watts per square meter for 10 billion years. That's what our sun's going to do. 10 billion years of life. Right now the solar constant is around 1,300 watts per square meter. It's going to do that for 10 billion years. Can you imagine getting all of that energy in 1 second? That's what a gamma ray burst is. And with this new telescope they're about to put up, I'm calling it the gamma ray burst detector, and they're also asking for people to help them rename it to give it a better name than the GLAST. I think it's called GLAST, if I remember correctly. They'd like to come up with a much better name for it. Gamma ray, something large ray space telescope, or something like that is what GLAST stands for. Back to you, Paul, for any other information. WS2N, KQLIW in effect, Matt.
Okay, Dick. I know some years ago I got an exploded view of the space station of what it was supposed to look like. They've changed that over the years. Now, was that from the internet? That was probably from the magazine, you know. So, but yeah, I have seen things on the internet, and don't think I have a complete. I'm sure there's a complete view. But I don't know, it's an awful lot to put on one page, so it would probably be relatively small. It would have to be like a couple of pages together. Right? It would be a better, out of a magazine would be better. Let me look around it. If I can find something, maybe I can make a photocopy and mail it to you. That would be easier. So I'm sure I got that somewhere. I'm waiting for you. The telescopes, yeah, I'm sure. We've got a lot of things coming up in the near future. James Webb telescope, that's still on the table. I thought they took that one off, but I heard that's still on the table. That's the one that's going to be sitting a million miles out. I think that's a couple of years away, though, Dick. They have the one that's up there now. It was a French telescope, French-built telescope, and that's a planet finder telescope. They're trying to analyze the data now and see if they can come up with a planet that looks like ours instead of gigantic Jupiter-sized type of planet. You can put a C, C-O, I forgot what it was. Karate, I think it is. But I'm waiting for May, actually. I'm anxious to see the Phoenix spacecraft land on Mars on close to the pole, landing of the Phoenix spacecraft. That I'm waiting for. That should be arriving in May. It's going to land in one spot. It's not going to ride around. It's not a rover, but it's to land in one spot and dig down into the ground. That should be interesting. Looking for biological signs of life or something. So anxious to see how this thing works out. It's got a big scoop on it, all kinds of cameras all over and everywhere, and chemical testing lab on board. This should be good. Back to you, Dick. I've held it long enough. This is WS2S.
I think I've heard that the Phoenix is going to land in the Mars Arctic area, and one of the things it's going to be looking for is water. We've come to the conclusion that most of the life as we know it requires water. There's strong evidence that Mars once contained water. The amount of water it contains right now is very important to whether or not it could sustain life or used to be able to sustain life. The lack of a magnetic field means that it doesn't have the Van Allen belt, which is giving us beautiful protection. And it's our shield. It doesn't have it, and as such, the solar wind is slowly peeling away its atmosphere and its water vapor. That's the best belief as to where it's going. So protecting water is very important. For man to go back to the moon and sustain ourselves there for any length of time, there's a strong need for water. And they're hoping that some of those craters that are at the North Pole and the South Pole of the moon, where the sun never gets a chance to get to the bottom of the crater, they're hoping that water could still be there in frozen form. I'm a bit skeptical about that because I know that in the hard vacuum of space, ice will slowly sublime. It'll slowly turn from solid directly to the vapor phase without even going to the liquid phase. So frozen ice in a vacuum lasts a lot longer than liquid water would, but it still does boil away. So is there any remaining water on Mars? I mean, correction, on the moon? We'll soon find out. But if there was, for our return mission to the moon, it would make a huge improvement in what life would be like in sustaining making oxygen out of the water, making hydrogen for fuel. Also, another thing you can do with the water, you can make rocket fuel out of it if you got it. Without water, life on the moon is going to be a lot more difficult. You got to bring up all the consumables. And one of the very rough calculations I've made is that a human being in 1 year consumes an amount of water, food, and oxygen that has the approximate volume of your house and the approximate weight of your house. That's what you consume in 1 year. So you put a bunch of astronauts on Mars or the space station or on the moon, and you have to supply those raw materials. And it's nice to say recycling, but to recycle every single molecule accurately, not so easy. We've got a lot, long way to go there. Okay, I'm going to pass it back to you, Mel. I'm hoping, I wonder if you've gotten any mail this week. I know you have. I've got an early appointment tomorrow, so I'm going to have to leave you guys at 11 o'clock tonight, which is an hour and 20 minutes away. So should everyone decide to continue beyond that, that is your choice, of course. I don't own this. I just use it, whatever it is. You know what I mean. So I'm going to be leaving you at 11, but between now and then, maybe you want to go into your mailbag, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. All right, anybody want to make any comments on any of the above before we go to the mailbag? Okay, just some people have said that we don't take a break for additional comments. All right, anyhow, let's see. I'm going to look here. I got one here on airs on a quad. I will not tell you the make of the quad, but it is a commercial quad. And it is a quad that is produced, and it works between 7 megahertz and 28 megahertz. In the last couple of years, I have had problems with it. The ice on the wire has broke, the ice loading on, ice buildup on the wire has broke the wire a number of times. And it has caused me the problem taking down the quad to repair it. The cost is very reasonable, of course, to repair it, but it's also, you know, quite a load of work. Usually takes me around 6 hours to take it down, repair it, put it up. The ice loading kinked the 1.25-inch tubing section of the upper spreader on, and the ice on the wire measured up at one time of a half inch in diameter. So you can imagine how easily it broke the loop wire. And my location, I don't know how to get to us, but my location is not far, right here in Pennsylvania. So that's the comments I got from this person about the quad stick. You want to make any comments about ice floating over?
I can, WCWK.
Okay, Eugene has had ice loading, and boy have I had ice loading. I've been living in Huntington since 1969, and I guess I've had about three significant ice storms. and I've taken some photographs from time to time of my 100-foot tower with all kinds of antennas on it, with half inch or so of radius of ice, bending all the elements and disturbing the antennas and cracking the trees and whatever. So ice is some pretty wicked stuff. My guess is ice on a cubicle quad can do a lot of damage. Ice on a Big Yagi can do a lot of damage. A person designing an antenna, knowing that ice is going to occur in our vicinity of the world, and particularly for people who live up even further north, it's going to happen every decade or so. And as such, if you can put the right kind of insulated materials, you know, acting as guy wires, Kevlar, or glass line on your elements with a king post going over to the main boom so that everything is supported against the ice loading, you could avoid a hell of a lot of failure of the antenna by just putting some extra doodads on it, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Eugene has got to say about ice. Have you had ice loading, and have you found great solutions to it, Eugene? W2EWK, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yes, I have there, Mr. Dick. Mr. Dick, I got a better idea than yours, 100% better. You know what? I have an antenna down in my basement, a dipole, you know, double dipole. And guess what? If you put stainless steel up there, it costs a little bit more money, you know, into the pennies, you will not have this problem, I guarantee it. If he does, there's another thing you can do is maybe put a heater up there, you know, a heater, QSL.
Yeah, heaters could solve the problem. Stainless steel, you're implying that the ice is not going to stick to the stainless steel. I'll admit it's going to come off the stainless steel a little bit easier because I guess it has a smooth surface to it. But I'll bet you stainless steel can still build up ice under certain conditions. So protecting an antenna from ice is not easy. One of the things that I've had to do on my towers, where I've got a ham-ham rotator mounted on a platform inside of a Rhone 25 in one case and a Rhone 55 in another case, is I've put a bunch of washers under the ham-ham, four or five washers under each one of the bolts, so that the ham-ham is up above the platform by an extra, half or three-quarters of an inch. And that way, ice around the bell of the ham-ham doesn't get a chance to freeze itself to that platform and jam my rotator in one particular location. So that plus also a protective device around the place where the mast goes into the top of the tower. The mast freezing to the tower, sleeving is one place, and the bell housing of the ham-ham on the platform is the other place where ice loading does take place. And in my case, I'm 300 feet above sea level from my land, another 100 feet from the tower. At that 400 feet above sea level, I probably get twice as much ice as anyone else on this island. Therefore, I've had to add these protective measures. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, Dick, you don't think stainless steel is real, real good on a cubicle quad?
Stainless steel is a nice material, and as a construction material, fantastic. It doesn't rust. I'll make sure that all my bolts and nuts are stainless steel so that they don't rust the tower. But still, I think ice can build up on it. Let's see what Mel thinks about that. Back to you, Mel.
Oh, yeah, Roger. I've taken some elaborate precautions against that. If I've observed it once, and I'm happy I did some previous work to prevent some problems, such as what you did with the rotor. I have a plate that goes between the rotor mounting bracket inside the tower and raises the rotor up on a piece of 3/4 inch piece of aluminum plate that I machined out to fit perfectly to the bottom of the ham-ham rotor. And over the bearings that fit, you know, I have two bearings that fit over top of the ham-ham and the next stages of the tower. And over each one of the bearings are protected by the cone-shaped sleeves. That, you know, they look like upside down, like you would use a funnel. actually got the fixed funnel upside down and just slip on. They were slipped onto the mast as it was put together. And they could be slipped up. There's a clamp, a hose clamp that holds them in place. Look them up, but I give it a sort of grease every so often, the bearing. But one time with a heavy loading of ice, oh boy, I saw stalagmites hanging down off those elements. That those elements, I thought, were going to snap with that amount of loading. The only one time I saw that, in fact, it broke a number of tree limbs of that heavy loading we had here right off the ocean. That was just a lot of vapor and temperature dropped, and boy, oh boy, that was really a coating of ice here that, you know, raised the on a sidewalk, but you were walking on about maybe 6 inches of ice. I remember that situation. You couldn't do anything with it because it was as hard as like trying to chop, you know, if you try your ice chopper or anything, it didn't penetrate that. So those stalagmites, boy, they scare you, you know, coming down from that height. One of those stalagmites can really impale you. So I'm happy my yard where the tower sits and all it fenced in, and for safety, nobody was allowed in the yard as well. You couldn't get in. I don't think it opened the fence. But those stalagmites, when they came down, they were really like deer. So I could see that there could be a problem with ice loading on a quad, and I think it could cause some havoc in this case. But like you say, Dick, it's only once in a very... very unusual situation. I guess the years I'm here, it's 1976, I think. Oh, 77. 70 around 76, almost 77. I only saw it once, Dick, over.
Yeah, you're a little, you're closer to the seashore, and you're also on slightly lower land than I am. I've had three good-sized ice storms since 1969. I'm here now, let's see. 30-some-odd years, if I've got the mathematics right, 38 years. So I guess every 12 or so years, I average a good ice storm on top of my hill. Quite often when people down in the valley, you know, 150 feet lower than me, I call it down in the valley. Quite often they get rain and I get snow. You know, 1 degree, 2 degrees, 3 degrees difference in temperature because of extra altitude will turn their rain into my snow. There was one particular... winter, let me think now, about 3 years ago when we had something like 15 inches of snow here, whereas a couple of miles away they only had, 9 inches of snow because some of the rain that they got, I got as snow. So I have to protect from ice, snow, high winds, and whatever. My towers have got closer guy spacing, heavier guy wire, and heavier screw anchors and redundancy in the screw anchors to try to protect me from that because my operation would come crashing down if I didn't do these kind of things, in my opinion. In the case of that array of 16 Yagis, which I knew I was building it to be light, had a thin wall tubing, and I had a calculated wind load of 78 miles an hour. And Hurricane Gloria in 1985 hit me with... about a 105-mile-an-hour wind at the top of my tower. So as the calculation indicated, that array of 16 Yagis got ripped off the tower, and most of that hardware got deposited into my front lawn. And that brought down all of those FMA cables and allowed me to make those measurements of what foam cable does with water vapor absorption. So keeping water out of cables is something really significant. So when you choose your feed lines, make sure that if it is a foam-filled cable, that there's a hermetic sealed foil underneath that can keep out the water vapor. That, if you're a really serious VHF, UHFer, go for hardline. And don't worry about the fact that it's 70-ohm hardline and you can get it for free. 70-ohm hardline has got lower loss than 50. And I've got more 70-ohm hardline on my property in use than 50. I've got very little 50-ohm hardline, because I couldn't get these great deals on it. And the 70-ohm stuff is fantastic. You're listening to a piece of 70-ohm hardline right now. Okay. I'm not quite sure what else I had a little bit of interruption here while you were reading that particular mail. Wonder if he has any other questions. And if not, maybe you want to go to the next fellow. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, I'm here for Rich. If you want to read about Wayne Overbach, N6MB did quite a study on quads versus Yagis. It was in May, it was all reviewed on May 1979, Ham Radio Magazine. Look at Ham Radio Magazine. I believe you can get that online. May 1979, Wayne Overbach, N6MB, quads versus Yagis. Did quite a study on this, Dick, over.
Fantastic. I kind of knew there was a ham radio article. I remember getting it. And was I correct in guessing, if you're looking at that article now, did I remember correctly he had something like an 80-foot crank-up tower on a trailer? And he went to each of the big guns in his neighborhood. I think he went to about 10 or 15 different guys. Some of them had Yagis, some of them had quads. And he tabulated all the field strengths he got from them. Tabulated what kind of an antenna they're running, how many feet up it was, how many miles away he was, and what kind of field strength he got. So he made real hard measurements in the real working environment of quads versus Yagis. And I seem to remember the article implying that there was a slight advantage to a quad, but it was not huge. I wonder if you recollect it somewhat like that, Mel. K2KEY, thank you for finding that article, K2LIW.
Hey, very good. Yeah, it's a 74-foot tower that he used to compare, and the beam he used was a TH6 DXX I-gain Yagi. And when the bad conditions are low, the Yagi takes over. And here it is, the comparison. He did a lot of comparisons, all kinds of comparisons. This was his comparison of a Yagi with signals to Europe and Central America. Improved up to 3S units on a quad under wide open conditions. When band conditions are low, the Yagi takes over. When a 20-meter band gets wiped out by rain static on a Yagi, I switch to the quad, and lo and behold, no static. So it shows you that the quad does do a job, especially under certain conditions. Dick, very interesting. I'm just summing up what he said, over.
Yeah, for an antenna that has almost the same pattern in three-dimensional space, almost the same amount of gain, the mechanism by which one could be a lot quieter than the other under noisy band conditions is a little bit amazing to me. If it doesn't have a huge difference in the pattern, how can it do that? Well, I am guessing he was getting precipitation static on the antenna itself. The good news about a cubicle quad is that it's essentially a full wavelength loop for the driven element, which means you could say that the input end and the output end of the drive points are DC grounded to each other, whereas a more conventionally fed dipole-like driven element of a Yagi doesn't have that natural characteristic built in. Natural DC short circuit. So under certain rainy conditions, the droplets come down with a charge on them, and as they touch your antenna, they create a charge buildup on the antenna and ends up as a kind of precipitation static. And if the antenna is DC grounded, I think you got a lot less of that. So that's a guess on my part as to how the quad could be quieter. Other than that, without having a huge difference in the pattern, how can one be quieter than the other if the noise is really coming out there in the environment from more than a mile away from the antenna, so to speak? Maybe you got a guess on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. The quad really was developed by who was that guy down in Central America up in that mountain up there, and found that the Yagi didn't work because of certain conditions, and that's how he came up, I believe, with the quad. I think you know that story, Dick, over.
No, I don't. And if you can tell me about it, would be helpful. Go ahead, Mel.
I only remember, you know, basically there was a station that was operating up on a mountaintop. I think maybe the guy in Chile. And the problem was that the Yagis were failing. And the noise and other problems he was having up there. And he found that the he came up with this concept of making a quad was the only kind of antenna that would stand up and work well in that environment up on the on that mountain. I think it may have been the one in Chile, Dick, over.
I think it was radio station HCJB, Chino, Ecuador. They were getting the rubber effect on the antenna up in the Andes Mountains. This was in 1958.
How about that, 1958? Yeah, I knew it wasn't Manfred von Henry, XQ2FOD. I didn't think it would be him. So, are you saying, Rich, and maybe Mel's going to confirm this, that the cubicle quad was essentially invented in 1958? Over to you, Rich.
That's my understanding, Rich. It may have been earlier than 58. I'm not sure of the year, but I know it was HCJB. They were getting corona effect on the antenna and using a closed loop for way loops solved the problem.
Now, is HCJB a commercial radio station, or is it a ham radio station? I didn't hear a number in there. Back to you, Rich.
No, and I don't know if they're still on. They were on up until a few years ago. They were a Christian radio station known as the Voice of the Andes on the shortwave band. And my understanding is the first quad operated somewhere very close
to the ham band. How about that? Over to you, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KDY. Yeah, I think I recall that whole article about the development of the quad because of the corona problems of destroying the Aggies and all. And I wasn't sure if it was, yeah, now that you mention it, Rich, I recall the article appeared in one of the magazines on the origin of the quad. Okay, shall we try another one, unless anybody has any questions so far in any of the above.
Fire
away. Okay, like I say, I will pause because I got a number of these comments that we don't stand by for comments about, previous discussions. Okay, let's see, what is this one? Oh, here's one. This one sounds interesting. Are you familiar with an antenna used by the military called the dielectric rod antenna? Dielectric rod antenna used for 1296 megahertz. Is this adaptable for amateur radio use? Dielectric rod antenna. I guess this is yours, Dick.
Yes, I am familiar with that. I've seen that in quite a few books. There's a chapter that includes that antenna in the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And so, let's explain what it is. Make believe you had a piece of waveguide, and the signal is traveling down the waveguide. At the point where you want to radiate the signal into space, you can start opening up the waveguide to larger dimensions, and that would really be a feed horn. So you could put a horn on the end of the waveguide, and we can all pretty much picture the way that wave goes down the horn, gets spread across that larger surface, therefore has a larger capture area on reception because of the lower reciprocity. It's going to do the same thing on transmission, and you can see how it's going to favor a particular direction in space. That's fact number one. Tack that into the back of your mind. Now, number two, let's go to a Yagi antenna. A Yagi antenna, if you could see the pattern coming out of the Yagi antenna, it would be a very fat, three-dimensional shape in space that would be very similar to a cucumber. So you could say a six-element Yagi, for instance, would give you a fat cucumber in space as its antenna pattern. And the way it works is that the directors are really a slow-wave structure. The directors are acting as a skeleton chunk of foam, so to speak, or a high dielectric chunk of foam. And so that's how the focusing takes place. The fact that it's got a particular shape, which really means the length of the directors and their positions in space, and the fact that the wave goes through those directors more slowly than it does in free space, very similar to the way it would going through a magnifying glass or a chunk of foam. So you can now see that once you accept the fact that a Yagi could be substituted with a big chunk of foam, you could remove all those directors, properly shape a big chunk of foam of the right dielectric constant, wrap it around the boom and the area where the directors are. In the case of a 432 Yagi, that chunk of foam would be something in the vicinity of 3/4 of a foot in diameter. And as long as you have the right velocity factors of the foam and the right shape of it and the right length, it would do pretty much the same thing that the directors do. On 432 and above, it's doable, but not practical. It's a big chunk of foam. It would be expensive, a lot of wind load. When you start getting up to the microwave frequencies, 5, 10, 15 gigahertz, that chunk of foam becomes something that's only an inch or so in diameter and multiple inches long, and it is a very easily designed slow-wave structure. So a dielectric rod antenna usually is something that's plugged into the end of a waveguide or a waveguide to coax adapter, and by choosing its shape, its dielectric constant, and its length, it has a similar pattern to a Yagi antenna. And to my knowledge, no one has made a dielectric rod antenna more than a couple of wavelengths long. Well, until recently, no one has made Yagi antennas where the boom was more than a couple of wavelengths long. Now that we've got these beautiful computer modeling programs, the current state-of-the-art in long Yagis, which is a commercial product of Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine, and the president of the company is Dave Olin, K1WHS, he has produced a 102-element Yagi. And everyone used to think that Yagis run out of steam when you go beyond 5, 10, 15, 20 elements, choose the right gear, and somebody will come along with knowledge telling you, don't go any longer than that because Yagis run out of steam. Well, it's because they didn't have good design techniques. When you've got modern computer techniques, computer modeling techniques, you can make a Yagi with 102 elements, and all of those elements are singing. They're all working. They're all doing their thing. And the thing has a predictable amount of gain. And so I'm not sure, but I'm going to guess that a 102-element Yagi is probably something like 15 wavelengths long. So could you make a dielectric rod antenna 15 wavelengths long? And as long as the loss tension of the plastic is low enough, would it give you the right amount of gain? I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. It's just a matter of time before somebody takes the currently existing computer modeling program and applies it to a dielectric rod antenna. Could be a very useful antenna at microwave frequencies. The so-called cigar antenna, so an antenna that's got a whole bunch of washers along a rod, which has been used on 2 gigs and above, it is another kind of slow-wave structure where you're using metallic objects to duplicate what the dielectric rod would do. So it's a sort of a skeleton rod, but once you understand the principle, you can see there's a number of ways to get that kind of an antenna, giving you the gain and directivity you desire. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Very good. This is K2KUY. Sounds very interesting. Question then. If we make one of these dielectric antennas for 10 gigahertz, 10 gigs, and compared it to a section of waveguide, would it be a improvement over, let's say, a section of, you know, of waveguide dick over?
Oh, boy, would it be an improvement. What a lot of people think, Mel, is that once you have a long piece of waveguide, that you force the signal in one direction like a shotgun or like a long rifle. Very good common sense. Dead wrong. The wave that comes out of a waveguide to coax adapter, coax to waveguide adapter, or the wave that comes out of a piece of waveguide that is 5 feet long, you open up the flange on the end of either one of those, either the waveguide to coax adapter that's an inch and a half long, or the piece of waveguide that's 5 feet long, the pattern coming out of it is the same.
to have the same aperture distribution at the throat of that antenna, at the mouth of that antenna, and that's the only thing that determines the battery. And by the way, an open-ended piece of waveguide is an antenna with something like 1.5 or 2 dB of gain. Or is it 1.5 Vizwar? I think the gain is more like 4 or 5 dB. It's got some directivity due to the flange. So it's not that you force the signal down the guide like a water hose and you think it's going to come squirting out the end, and the longer the waveguide, the higher the gain. Good common sense doesn't work that way. The dielectric rod really is a slow wave structure similar to a Yagi. My 19-element Yagi on 432 had all the elements roughly 12 inches long, 13 feet of boom, but each of the elements were 12 inches long. You look down the throat of that Yagi, you see a 1-inch diameter boom, and you see these elements all behind each other, 1 foot long. Believe it or not, that antenna captures signal from a 5.7-foot diameter of space. If your eyes operated at that frequency and you look down that antenna, you would see a black hole in space, 5.7 feet in diameter, even though it's made out of elements that are only 1 foot long. It's the slow wave structure that causes that signal to fold in, very similar to a magnifying glass, gathering sunlight over a large area and focusing it down to a point. That slow wave structure of the directors takes that 5.7 foot diameter of space, focuses that signal down to the driven element, which picks it up, sends it down the feed line, and pegs the S-meter on a good day. So a dielectric rod does that. An open-ended piece of waveguide does not. So does a dielectric rod have gain? Yeah. You could make one easily with 10 or 15 dB of gain. The open-ended piece of waveguide is never going to have more than a couple of dB of gain, and the gain is only a function of the size of the flange you have on the end of it, acting like a horn, if you know what I mean, Mel. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. It sounds very interesting. Okay, so how come we haven't seen, you know, more uses of this? Now, if I was to take, you say, let's say I took a waveguide, WR90 waveguide, and now you're telling me that if I have a dielectric antenna, how many different dB did you say that I could most likely get from a dielectric antenna as compared to the waveguide, Dick? And what happens to the vertical bandwidth and the horizontal bandwidth in such a situation, Dick? Over.
It's almost identical to a Yagi, Mel, believe it or not. They're both slow wave structures with a particular velocity profile that operate by Huygens' principle. They give you the focusing of the energy, very similar to a magnifying glass. A 19-element Yagi is capable of a horizontal beam of 23 degrees and a vertical beam width of something like 26, 27 degrees. So a Yagi, even though it's only made out of horizontal elements, focuses that energy both in azimuth and in elevation. A dielectric rod on the end of a piece of waveguide, properly designed, can easily have 10 dB of gain, with a little bit more difficulty, could have 15 dB of gain, and it would have about 25 degrees of horizontal beam width and around 27 degrees of vertical beam width. That dielectric rod would be focusing the energy horizontally and vertically at the same time, very similar to what a Yagi does. It's a very similar principle of operation, even though your eye sees a hugely different antenna. That radio wave, a radio wave on 432 megacycles, for instance, the wavelength is 27 inches long, but all the elements of the antenna are only 12 inches long. In other words, if my eyes worked at 432 megacycles, I could not see the individual details of those individual directors. The directors are sub-wavelength in size. I could not resolve them. All I would see out there is a cloud of something that you and I call the director string, and that director string, that cloud, has a certain velocity factor to it, certain dielectric constant equivalent to it, and if it's got the right shape and the right length, it has focusing capability. By the same token, that wave coming out of that waveguide, WR90, at 10 gigahertz, the waveguide is 9/10 of an inch wide, 0.45 inches high, but the wavelength is 1.1 inches.
they can just barely see the waveguide, so to speak. It doesn't see the individual sharp edges, so to speak, of that dial guide focusing device. It just sees that cloud out there, and that cloud acts like a magnifying glass in both cases. So even though your and my eye has the ability to see these fine details, that wave does not. And as such, you can get away with murder when it comes to violating the fine details, as long as the overall equivalent dielectric constant and equivalent velocity factor and proper shape, you do the right shape, the right velocity factor of that dial guide, and you can get any gain that you can get out of a Yagi-like structure, Mel. There's many kinds of antennas that have not yet been properly investigated. All of the Babbitt's rule antennas that are part of the science called frequency selective surfaces, which are inverse antennas. In other words, most of the HF and VHF antennas you and I use are a piece of conductor in the vacuum of free space, or in the air, so to speak. So we have a small amount of metal and a whole lot of air, and if you arrange the pieces of metal just right, we call it an antenna. Every one of those antennas that you know about has an inverse, where instead of air being the insulator everywhere, I make a sheet of metal that's conductive everywhere, and I cut slots in it, and I call those slots antennas, the inverse antennas. Well, you could say the dial guide is a kind of a, almost an inverse antenna. It's a different way of constructing a Yagi. And so all of these inverse antennas have not yet been properly investigated with computer modeling. So for people who are studying computer science right now, if you think you don't have any challenges left, you ain't seen nothing yet. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. This is fascinating.